You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hawkins, tōko ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome back to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 26th of July. Can you believe it's that late in the year already? I'm your host, Jessica Hopkins, and I'll be with you for the next hour along with my producer, Louis. First up on the show, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to have James Shaw today, but I will be talking to Drowning Prevention Auckland about World Drowning Prevention Day that happened yesterday, and then I'll also be speaking with Dr. Mals Barton about the Stop the Chop campaign. Louis, what have you got for us this week?
I spoke to the Victoria University's Jason Young about New Zealand's allegations of Chinese state-sponsored cyber attacks. I also spoke to the lead developer of Katuko Island, which is a new Maori-based video game, and I spoke to the lead developer, Dr. Phyllis Callahan. And lastly, I spoke to Just Speak's Tanya Meads on police calling for guns, which was a follow-up interview from my interview last week with the Police Association's Chris Cahill.
Awesome. So that's coming up on The Wire soon. Ka ua I wariwari I ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene korero ano he pakehere roki roki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho mihari ki 95BFM era kati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And as always, you can text 5395 or call 309 3879 if you have any thoughts on our pieces today.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
In April, the United Nations adopted a resolution on drowning prevention, establishing it as an issue of international significance. New Zealand, along with more than 80 countries worldwide, co-sponsored this. I talked to Nicola Keane Bigelow from Drowning Prevention Auckland about World Prevention Day that happened yesterday.
So drowning is the leading cause of recreational death and the third highest cause of accidental death in New Zealand. The fatal drowning rate is 1.59 per 100,000 people, and this is at the higher end of the OECD countries. Last year we had 74 deaths due to drowning. So there is still more to do as a country to address drowning.
In April of this year, the United Nations adopted a resolution specifically on drowning prevention and established an international or a World Drowning Prevention Day with New Zealand and more than 80 other countries sponsoring this. So what do you believe declaring drowning prevention as an issue of international significance will achieve?
I think this is absolutely fantastic because drowning is very silent and it's very invisible. So an international focus really raises this issue as being important. It enables us to come together globally around how we address this, and we're already doing that with a lot of our research that does inform program development around the world. So I think it really does help us all affirm that we do need to collaborate, we need to come together. This issue isn't going to go away with the way that we're currently working.
While a lot of our listeners might not be swimming right now, as it's winter, it's a key time for sort of teaching children water safety skills. So is enough being done here in New Zealand to ensure that all children have basic swimming and water safety skills?
There is a lot of amazing work being done across the country, and there's many programs in place to support children to learn to swim and to learn water safety. There definitely needs to be more done in enabling every child to have access to that education. And part of that, if we could get some curriculum changes so that it was part of the curriculum for every New Zealand child had a right to learn how to swim. And additionally, water safety skills. So drowning prevention isn't just about knowing how to swim. It's what do you do if you unintentionally end up in the water? How do you keep yourself safe? So it's it's both of those being of equal importance. And there's many barriers for some of our communities around the cost of swimming lessons, access to pools, school pools now closing down. So there's a lot of work happening across the sector of how we address these barriers, but certainly having every child learning these skills will greatly enhance their ability to enjoy the water safely.
Yeah, so what are some initiatives that Drowning Prevention Auckland are working on right now in this area?
So Drowning Prevention Auckland has a number of education programs across all ages and stages of life. So we do work with early childhood, we do work in primary school, secondary schools, and also with pre-service teachers that are coming out of tertiary organisations. And I'm also really proud of our work around ethnic communities. So we have an Asian advisor, we work with New Settler communities, we have programs for Māori and Pacifica. So our breadth and depth of programs is significant, and that some of the collaborative work that we're doing that also enables us to work with other sector partners to address region-wide issues around drowning. We've been working for 15 years with the Lifesaving Northern Region and Auckland Council on rock fishing on the west coast, because that has been a key area of drowning for many years. And that's, you know, an exciting example of what can be achieved when sector agencies come together with their skill and expertise. Another one is some work that we've done at Hinawa Falls, again with Auckland Council, Water Safety New Zealand and YMCA, at how can we keep a waterfall environment safe for people visiting. So we still want people going there and enjoying the waterfall, but we really don't want them swimming there. So we've trialled a water safety advisor program there, and we're now looking at how we can address signage differently and how we can potentially use technology to highlight hazards as people, 300,000 people that go there each year, so that they know what the hazards are.
Do you have any general advice for some things people should be aware of when it comes to water safety here in New Zealand?
Well, personally, I'm an absolute advocate for under fives. I think our young children are relying on adults to keep them safe. And if the one key message that I could get out today would be about active supervision, that drowning happens really quickly. It can happen under 30 seconds in 4 centimetres of water. So whenever you're at a water environment with your family, please stay off your phones. Please keep an eye on your children. And be within reach if they get into trouble so that you can prevent them from drowning.
And just lastly, what would be the priority actions, in your opinion, that should happen following World Drowning Prevention Day yesterday?
I think it's a wonderful opportunity as we have just launched Wai Ora Aotearoa, which is a sector-wide water safety strategy across New Zealand. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to continue to come together in the right way to really champion drowning prevention messages and activities and programs throughout the country. And I'm, you know, really excited to be part of that and really doing our piece within Auckland to lead that implementation of the strategy so that all Aucklanders are safe and on and around the water.
And that was Drowning Prevention Auckland. And Louis has a piece for us up next. Louis, can you talk a bit about your piece?
Last week, the New Zealand government joined other nations, including America and Great Britain, in condemning numerous cyber attacks associated with the Chinese government. But there have been worries that China, who are New Zealand's largest trading partner, may retaliate through export restrictions. To get a better understanding of the issue, I spoke to Jason Young, who is a professor in politics and international relations at Victoria University and the director of the New Zealand Contemporary China Research Centre. I began by asking him to give context to New Zealand's statement on Chinese cyber attacks.
On the 19th of July, the Minister for the Government Communication Security Bureau, Andrew Little, put out a statement condemning malicious cyber activity and then attributed it to Chinese state-sponsored actors, i.e. the Chinese Ministry of State Security. Now, this is not the first time that New Zealand has publicly called out China or the Ministry of State Security in terms of cyber activity in New Zealand. They did it once before in 2018, and there's also been a number of other attributions. But this is the first time that they've used such really strong language.
Yeah, and obviously China and New Zealand's top trading partner, and since the government statement, there's been a lot of speculation on whether China will impose sanctions. How do you expect them to respond to New Zealand's statement?
So I guess in terms of the strong language, I think it's the right thing to do. And, you know, the New Zealand government have been very clear over the last 3 years that they value the relationship with China, that they want to keep maintaining the trading relationship. But if there are issues that touch on national security or issues that touch on New Zealand values, for example, human rights issues, then they will make very clear statements. So I don't think that would be unexpected. So in terms of what impact this type of statement could have on New Zealand's political relationship with China, and then whether or not that would then have a flow-on effect onto the economy, it's perhaps too early to tell. The Chinese embassy in New Zealand have issued a response. They said it was totally groundless, irresponsible, strong dissatisfaction, and a malicious smear. And they sort of described it as being symptomatic of a type of Cold War mentality. So, you know, as with previous issues in the past, when New Zealand's made statements on Xinjiang or made statements on Hong Kong, we've seen a sort of a response from the Chinese embassy, but we haven't seen any impact on the trading relationship to date. In fact, New Zealand's trade with China is at its highest point ever.
So how exactly do you manage to keep trade and politics separate, especially on such big calls like this one?
It's a good question. I think it's impossible to keep trade and politics separate. Even free traders are advocating political agreements through free trade agreements, which are inherently political. I think the only thing that a country like New Zealand and a number of other liberal democracies can do is to signal very clearly that New Zealand institutions, New Zealand values support democracy and will have challenges and issues with the type of country or type of state, type of politics that China has. And so there will be a number of times when New Zealand will make statements, and they can, I guess if they signal that, then it doesn't come as a surprise. And then I think also the wording of those statements is really important. At the same time, the New Zealand government maintaining focus on trying where it can to work cooperatively with the Chinese government.
Yeah, because obviously late last year there was the issues with China and Australia. How come then that New Zealand hasn't seen the same response, given that we have still issued statements against Chinese actions this year and in the past?
So there's a number of different interpretations of that. One of the interpretations which we hear in Australia or in New Zealand is that the Chinese government have wanting to make an example of Australia and not taking the same type of punitive measures towards New Zealand as a way of showing Australian scholars and Australian government that it doesn't have to go that way, that, for example, New Zealand can be a model. So that's one of the explanations. Another one is that New Zealand has taken many of the same actions in real sense that Australia has, but the way that New Zealand has presented its case and the way that it's worded its statements has been noticeably different to Australia, and so not so aggressive. And then if what I read in the Chinese press and in Chinese government statements seems to be that their assessment is that Australia has taken a more aggressive approach and sees itself as America does, presents itself as in strategic competition with China, whereas New Zealand's position is a lot more grey in terms of this question of strategic competition with China.
Do you think that we could see greater backlash from China, not just to New Zealand, but in a broader sense, given the recent statements concerning COVID-19, the treatment of Uyghur population, and now cyber hacking?
This is a moment in history where the People's Republic of China has become a very powerful country in terms of its material resources, and it's become a great power. And the people of China and the government of China want that power to then be transferred into influence internationally, as all great powers have done. And so we've seen this pushback from a number of countries along a number of different areas, calling out China in terms of its human rights abuses, but also in terms of relations with countries like Australia, but also some relations in Southeast Asia, some of its businesses, trade practices, territorial issues like Senkaku, Diaoyu Island, also South China Sea, et cetera, et cetera. And now the new thing is that the Chinese government are now more assertive in pushing back on that type of condemnation. So it will be really interesting to see how China recalibrates its relationships, particularly with the Western liberal democracies, in light of this growing animosity between them.
So how can New Zealand then balance its beneficial relationship with China, especially as our traditional allies kind of continue to criticise their actions?
To go back to what I was saying before, is that New Zealand politicians over the last few years, anyway, have been a lot clearer, I think, in what New Zealand values are, what New Zealand stands for in terms of international rules-based order, rule of law, human rights, democracy, and have made that very, very clear, and have also made and strengthened relationships with traditional partners and allies like Australia, but also strengthening relations with the United States, strengthening relations with the European Union. And this is all good, but at the same time, also working very hard to maintain a working, feasible relationship with the People's Republic of China that doesn't compromise our values or what we're trying to achieve in the world, but at the same time doesn't try to put at jeopardy the important economic relationship we have with businesses in China.
On a slightly broader scale, I guess, there seems to be limited principles for how states can respond to state-sponsored cybercrime. And as cybercrime becomes increasingly prevalent, do you think that there's a need for an international agreement about cybersecurity and things concerning that?
So there already are a number of bilateral agreements and multilateral agreements that countries have signed up to, and there's And so, yes, an international agreement that all countries would sign up to and agree what the rules of the road are in terms of cyber activities would be good. But also I think that what we see is that there are a number of states around the world that, even with those agreements in place, will still see cyber activity as a means to an end. And so what we're really talking about is state-sponsored criminal activity. And that can only really be stopped if countries call it out, publicly shame those countries when these types of things happen, and then also put in place protections for their own technology within the country. So I don't think this will go away, and I don't think states, particularly states which have less accountability, will not use this as a tool of international relations in the future.
That was Victoria University's Jason Young speaking on New Zealand's condemnation of Chinese cybercrime. We'll go to ads now and we'll be back after the break. See you later.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialist. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
Tree huggers,
planet lovers,
fashion disruptors.
Get ready for less waste, more love
with Outlive. Outlive redesigns and upcycles pre-loved clothing and textiles into rad, unique, one-of-a-kind bags. Teaming up with like-minded local charities like Sea Cleaners means that with every Outlive bag, more goes back into the community, inspiring conscious change through regenerative fashion.
Outlive, eco-friendly, slow fashion handbags, purses and totes.
Go to outlive.co or find them on Facebook and Insta at Outlive Official.
95 BFM Breakfast is good for your health. And to prove it, they're giving away a Be Nourished health food pack on the show every day this week. With one Be Nourished kimchi, one Be Nourished sauerkraut, and one bottle of Be Nourished gut shot. Just internet surf your B card and stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast all this week for your cue to enter. Three cheers for intestinal welfare. Woohoo!
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Pactive by Yeji. Louis, what have you got for us next?
Last week, I spoke to New Zealand Police Association's Chris Kahu about the need for more protections for police officers. Kahu stressed that there are already too many guns in the community and the officers are increasingly calling for better firearm access. But I wanted to get a different perspective on the issue. So this morning, I spoke to Tanya Meads, who is director of criminal justice organisation Just Speak. We talked about the need for trust between the police force and the public, as well as the disproportionate impacts of armed officers. I began by asking her what she thought about the Police Association's recent call for better access to firearms.
We don't think that we need any more guns in Aotearoa at the moment, and what happens when police carry more weapons and have more readily accessible is that more people tend to get hurt, particularly people in the community, particularly people who are really at the most risk of experiencing violence from police, which in Aotearoa mostly involves rangatahi Māori and young Pacifica, but also police tend to get hurt. There tends to be an escalation of violence. When we look at what has unfolded in places like the United States, with the general arming of police, that's not a track that we want to go down here in New Zealand.
Spoke to Police Association's Chris Kahu last week. He said that firearms are already too prevalent among the community in New Zealand and there's actually no other alternative at this point.
Well, that's just not true. There definitely is an alternative. And there are too many firearms in the community. And, you know, what we see underway with the firearms return process that this government has initiated is a really important way of disarming the community, making sure that there are fewer guns in our communities. But many, many people in New Zealand, particularly people who are already marginalised, do not feel any more safe when police carry weapons. And what is most likely to happen is that more young people in the community will be hurt. That is not an outcome that anyone wants, and I understand that the fear that some people are experiencing because it is being deliberately whipped up by some people in the community can lead to this desire to match weapons with more weapons, but that is not the only outcome. It is certainly not the outcome that any of us, I think, want for our communities, and that is not the best way to keep New Zealand safe and flourishing.
In response to increased firearm use in the community and more threats to police officers, what alternatives would you suggest other than increasing firearm use by police?
I'd like to see first the stats on what evidence we have that the instances of gun crime in the community are in fact increasing. When we see multiple incidents happen over a short space of time, it can be easy to believe that that means that there's a change in the pattern or in the incidents over an annual time period, for example. But often, if we look at the evidence over time, we see that actually it's relatively insignificant. So for starters, I think beyond what is in the headlines, let's look sensibly at what is actually happening in our communities and understand what the threat is. Secondly, the best thing that we can do to prevent gun crime is actually focus on de-escalation, because what we often see happen when in jurisdictions where police and other armed forces go in with a high amount of weaponry, is that situations tend to escalate quite quickly and more people get hurt. So we'd like to see a greater focus on police and other frontline response agencies being able to de-escalate situations before they get to that. And the way that we do that is understanding what is driving instances of harm in our community and working together on those to resolve those before they create risky situations.
Is there the issue that if police do become more armed, there's going to be disproportionate impacts on marginalised mm-hmm. communities? Does that especially focus on Māori and Pacifica?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what we see is that young Māori and Pacifica in particular, but all Māori and Pacifica communities are much more likely, many, many times more likely, to be hurt or killed by police with guns. And that's true in New Zealand. It's also true when we look at minority, Indigenous and people of colour in other communities as well, particularly in the United States, in Britain, everywhere really. And that's a pattern that we cannot undo by arming police more. That, you know, we cannot improve the statistics, improve outcomes for young people in our community who don't feel safe by arming police more. So we need to look at what the alternatives are. Otherwise, we're going to continue down this path where the people who are already most marginalised in our community continue to feel unsafe and are directly put at risk by decisions like this.
So there's obviously the issue you mentioned before, the issue of where public fear the police and there's a lack of trust. So how do we make sure that people don't want firearms and don't think they need them?
Well, for starters, it's really unhelpful when organisations like the Police Association, who know very well that when we see increasing armaments of police and police carrying guns on their bodies, that fundamentally changes the relationship of the police to the community. And that is well documented in evidence, both here in Aotearoa as well as internationally. That is not the kind of action that builds a reciprocal relationship of trust between particularly marginalised communities and the police. So we need people to calm down. We need the Police Association, I think, to sit down and think about, understand that they are there to represent the best interests of their members, and what long-term is going to get the best outcomes for their members is not general arming. So I think that narrative of fear is really unhelpful for building a sense of the space and time we need to discuss as a community what are the best responses to gun violence in our community, how can we get guns out of our communities.
So what then would you say to police officers who have increasingly said that they do not feel safe carrying out basic duties like road stops, and that the issue is that they feel like they need firearms?
Yeah, it's really scary being in any kind of job, including police officers, including at any frontline service job where you are interacting with people and there's always that risk of escalation. And I understand that. I think there's an enormous bravery and enormous difficulty that all kinds of frontline people and emergency services have in that work. But carrying weapons is not the solution to building safety in our communities. I think that the situations that many frontline workers, social workers, police, teachers find themselves in and the risks of an escalation are driven by structural and systemic failures in our communities, and what we need is communities better resourced to look after people, their own whānau, their own families, and understand what's going on for them to prevent situations like that from happening in the first place. And look, that, you know, responding to that, that's a big question. That's not a question that police alone can fix. That's about better mental health in our communities. That's about better resourcing for whānau. That's about, you know, making sure that young people are not excluded from education. Those things are complicated and they require leadership from government and not just from you know, justice agencies. But ultimately, that is the best way that we actually get safety for our community, again, particularly for those who have the most reason to fear violence from police.
That was Just Speak's Tanya Meads speaking on the Police Association's call for better protections for police officers. Next up, I spoke to Kaituku Island's lead developer, Dr. Phyllis Callahan, on the This is because the game Kaituku Island was released on mobile devices on Thursday. It is the first fully Maori video game, having been developed upon a Mātauranga Maori lens and including challenges like carving, art, and te reo. We talked about the significance of this game and how it was influenced by her education background. To start, I asked her to give a brief overview of what the game is about.
So the game is about the world ends, basically, the largest city in the world, and you have to make your way to the only uncontaminated island left in the world in the South Pacific, and that island is called Kaituku. So on the way, you face some challenges, and then when you get there, you have to kind of like collaborate with a clan or other gang members to survive everything that the island has to throw at you. And the unique, I guess, element about Kaituku and what makes it a world first is that it's the first time an Indigenous gaming app has been done from start to finish from a Mātauranga Māori lens. So everything that you see